Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. As many of you know, WikiLeaks released a classified U.S. military video that showed what they said was an indiscriminate killing of over a dozen people in the Iraqi suburb of New Baghdad. It was committed by Bravo Company 216, a unit that was made famous by a book written by the Good Soldiers, written by a Washington Post reporter who was with that unit. And so this has gone all over the place, and it's called CollateralMurderer.com. And so everybody in America was horrified who saw this about the argument was this is cold-blooded murder. Well, you know, war is a terrible thing, and war is, you don't understand it unless you've been in it yourself. We are lucky today to have two men with us who fought in that company who want to talk about their thoughts about this. Josh Stiber is a combat veteran from Bravo Company 216, the unit in this WikiLeaks video. He was a conscientious objector while in the United States Army and is now a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War. Ethan McCord served in the Navy from 2002 to 2005. Then he transferred to the United States Army. And he's also a combat veteran from Bravo Company 216, who served from April to November 2007. And he was sent home because of injuries resulting from an IED attack. He's in the video that we're talking about. He's the young soldier seen grabbing the young children out of the van that was shut up, that was putting in a wounded Iraqi. And he is shown carrying the children away from that scene to bring them to medical care. We want to welcome them both to the airwaves, Josh Stiber and Ethan McCord. Thank you, gentlemen, both for what you did for the country, but also for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And the number here is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. We played some of the tape the other day, and we might play a few segments here during the course of this conversation with Josh and Ethan. But, Josh, this let me start with you. I mean, because you've been in the media. You were on Amy Goodman's show just the other day, I think, if that's correct.
Yes.
And Democracy Now! It's on the station. And you wrote a really interesting, what I thought even more interesting to me was the piece that you wrote. Let me kind of pull it up here as we're talking. You wrote this very powerful piece about your perspective on that. To talk a bit about, first of all, you went into the Army on your own. Obviously, everybody here is a volunteer. This is not Vietnam, so you weren't drafted. Something happened to you in Iraq, in the Army, that made you come to believe and become a conscientious objector. Tell us that story very quickly.
To try and sum it up real quick.
I'm sorry, but just tell that story.
Okay. I guess I would point to the video as illustrating a few of those things. One, the language used in it, I think, exemplifies the result of extensive military training trying to dehumanize a person, and for a while I went along with it and eventually reached the point where I realized that what I was being not only asked to do, but the way I was being asked to think was against who I wanted to be as a person, and I got to a point where I realized I had to act on that and eventually applied as a conscientious objector following the deployment in which the video took place.
And when the video that took place, the helicopter attack, that eight men were seen, and they were seen, and they said carrying weapons, and that was part of the controversy, which we'll talk about during the course of this hour. They were shot. One was wounded. And when a blue van came to pick them up, which apparently had no weapons in it, but a blue van came to pick up the one wounded Reuters photographer who was an Iraqi, that was attacked. Which is when Ethan McCord and his unit came upon the van and found the two children. You were back at the FOB, at the forward operating base, at the base, because they didn't want you going out on patrol because you'd become a conscientious objector. Is that correct?
I technically didn't even know what conscientious objection was until I got home from deployment.
Really?
Yeah, so it was, going along with it, it was a decision a couple days earlier not to obey a command I was given, and that didn't go over so well with my leaders, and they don't want me going out on missions for a certain amount of time.
Do you mind my asking, what was it you refused to do?
It was a somewhat similar situation where I was told to open fire where I didn't think it was justified, and I didn't, and told my leaders why I didn't, and that I didn't feel justified in doing it, and again, they weren't too pleased with that.
That's interesting. What I find interesting is this video and what your conversation now is coming on the heels of the Rideout Prize that was given out last week, being named after the man who stopped me lie with his helicopter as a helicopter pilot. And the award is given out in his name as somebody standing up when they see something they shouldn't be done, which takes a lot of heart to do, which I found an interesting juxtaposition of times. Ethan McCord, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir.
And you have served this country in the armed services for a long time. You went from the Navy to the Army.
Correct.
You and I had a really interesting conversation this afternoon.
Right.
You're seen in this video coming up after the American military had opened fire both on the eight men and then on the van.
Right.
And you were seen carrying these children away. Your perspective on it, I thought, was pretty profound, and I think I'd just like you to tell your story, as you did this afternoon.
Okay. When we were in a firefight a few blocks away when this incident happened, we heard the gunships opening fire. Us on the ground didn't know what was going on at the time, but when we were told to move now, to get to this position, we went down to that position, and what we came across was actually quite horrifying in a sense, but it didn't seem real. Even in real life, it didn't seem real. It seemed like something you would see out of maybe a movie or something like that. First thing I did was run up to the van, and I saw a little girl sitting on the seat, and a little boy halfway on the floorboard with his head laying on the seat next to his sister, and the father slumped over. I originally thought that the boy had passed, and the little girl had a wound to the stomach and had glass in her hair and eyes. And my immediate response was to grab this child, and I grabbed the medic, and we went into the back. There was houses behind where the van was, and I took the girl there, and we worked on her as much as possible, making sure that there was no exit wounds or anything, because we didn't really know what had exactly happened at that time. And handed the girl to the medic, who then ran her to the Bradley. I in turn went back to the van, and that's when I saw the boy somewhat take a breath, and I started yelling out that the boy was still alive, the boy's alive, and I grabbed him and started running him towards the Bradley myself. I placed him in the Bradley, which I got yelled at afterwards for doing that.
Talk about that. Why were you yelled at by your platoon commander?
Because my main focus wasn't on pulling security, going to a rooftop and pulling security. My main focus was to pull those injured children out. The first thing I thought of when I saw those children were my children at home. And I can't stand to see children like that. So that was my main priority, and I didn't care what anybody said at that time.
Gentlemen, I want to play a short clip because I want to let you talk a bit about a lot has been made of the language that your comrades used both in shooting the first time from the helicopter and in the way people expressed their feelings and emotions at what they were experiencing in this war. And I think that, you know, we look at these things and we hear it in civilian ears and you are horrified. And I want to play this clip, and I want the two of you to kind of talk with us about the kinds of things we talked about before in terms of your perceptions of this. Let's run this clip.
Still fired. Roger.
Got him. 2-6, we're moving. We got
13. Oh, sorry.
Bypass.
All right. Roger, currently engaging approximately 8 individuals, KIA, RPGs, and AK-47s. The Hotel 2-6, Crazy Horse, 1-8.
Oh, yeah, look at those dead men.
Square 0-2-3-10.
Nice.
Well, let's go to the second clip, the one we want to hear, the one we're talking about when we find the van and the child.
Where's that van at? Right down there by the body.
Okay.
Crazy Horse, we have individuals going to the scene, looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
I mean,
hey, we need to stop that. So we get down there. We
shoot.
You see my
Roger. Break. Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage.
Picking up the wounded. Yeah, we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
A Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
We're taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
It's Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV or bongo truck picking up the box. Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on.
So let's just talk a bit about I didn't quite get the set I was looking for, but let's talk about the language and what happens in these situations. And I think Ethan and Josh, you wrote an interesting piece kind of reflecting on that. And Ethan, you were talking to me today about what actually happens in the midst of battle that people who have not experiences don't understand. And Josh, I thought, let me start with you. You really kind of articulated well in your article that even though you became against war and killing, and now remember the Iraq Veterans Against the War, that notwithstanding, you were also trying to make people understand things they just don't understand unless they've been through this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of my major points is saying that, again, this is an indication of the system as a whole, and just seeing the public outcry about the video directed at individual soldiers, I think, is wrong. I think there should be outcry about it because, you know, obviously a lot of things, the video shows a lot of very intense things, but again, they were not out of the ordinary. And this weekend, Secretary of Defense Gates gave his stamp of approval and said, you know, pretty much that the soldiers were doing what they were supposed to. So, again, this is what the military looks like, and this is what war looks like. And if people don't try to understand that and try to understand the context in which all this happened, from the context of that day to the context of what our military training looks like, then we're missing a much-needed conversation about the nature of this entire war in general. And again, just focusing on a few people, and I guess to kind of put it into an analogy, the saying that goes, the nature of the beast, that what is shown in this video is the nature of the beast, and I feel like by directing all our outcries to what the fangs look like, then we're not going to ask the questions in our own society of what the rest of the beast looks like and how we put people in this situation where a lot of guys thought, you know, that they were doing good things and that they were serving their country or defending the weak through their actions, and obviously ended up doing something a lot different than they expected.
Ethan, I mean, I'd like you to pick up from there. You were talking, you said some things to me this afternoon that really touched me pretty deeply, and you were talking about how the person you went over there with, the person who joined the army, was a different person that came out of the army.
Oh, of course, yes. Before I joined the military, and even when I was in the Navy, I was a different person. I didn't go to Iraq. I didn't actually fight in any battles. Was serving my country. I joined the Army. I switched over to the Army, and from the very get-go, in basic training, they're telling you you know everything's about killing this person. From the cadences that we march to as they call muscle memory of firing, you know, it's your instinct to just fire. Don't think about it, just fire. It's muscle memory. To the what you become in Iraq. When I first went to Iraq, I thought I was going to help the people of Iraq. And maybe I was living in a fairy tale world, but I thought that we were going to help these people. And when we get there, and almost on a daily basis, we're getting blown up and shot at. And this is before we even did anything there. We just were out riding around. We hadn't had any contacts or anything, but then we started getting blown up and shot at just for the mere presence of us there. You tend to get a little angry and have a little ill will towards people who are doing this. Because you're like, I'm here to help you, and you're doing this to me. You're trying to take my life. And when thrown into a situation of it's my life or theirs, and I don't care who you are, you're going to choose your life. And if that means turning yourself into something that you're not, then you're going to do that, because you have to become mentally tough in the situation, and even you turn into a very hateful person while you're there. But yeah, I came out of the Army a much more angry person than I was before I went in. And have a lot of problems stemming from the Army that I didn't have before.
I want to come back to some of what you just said and kind of explore something from both of you. I think that what's really important here is what we're talking about in terms of our listeners getting a sense of what the two of you, two very sensitive men who have been through war, are talking about in terms of both the missing parts of what we're not seeing in this video when it comes to being a soldier yourself and what you see and what you hear, and what happens to you as you come home, which we're going to come back to. Let's play one more clip. This is a clip I said earlier that the man you just heard, Ethan McCord, was at the end of this video carrying the children from the van. And both Josh Stiber and he were in this company. And are coming to talk to us with a different perspective on what this video shows. Let's just play this clip and come back to Ethan and Josh.
11 Iraqi PIAs, one small child wounded, over.
Ethan McCord, you were saying to me that when you, after you took these, rescued these two children, and you went back to the base, to the FOB, that you requested to go to the mental health officer.
Correct.
What happened?
Well, I was having a hard time with seeing the children like that. I kept thinking of my own children at home, and was just having a really rough time getting out of my. I mean, I had blood from the children all over my uniform, and as I'm trying to clean the blood off of my uniform, just a flood of emotions were going through me. I had to handle them. I requested to go see the mental health there on the FOB, and a couple of the sergeants and stuff were calling me names of... a lot of like pansy names and saying that I needed to suck it up and get the sand out of me and that if I was to go that there would be repercussions and to be prepared for the repercussions of going to mental health. So I chose not to go to mental health at that time, because I didn't want to be, quote, bullied anymore by the sergeants who didn't feel that it was a necessary idea for me to go to mental health. Now, can I elaborate on something as far as the language used by the helicopter?
Is this Ethan?
Crew? What's that?
Is it Ethan?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yes, please do. Yeah.
When you're in a combat situation and you have people firing at you and you're firing back at people, the language that you use is more along the lines of a coping mechanism for yourself. When you joke about it, and it's to try to push that emotion of anger and everything else that's inside of you, anger for being in that position that you have to do something like that, anger at the people for putting you in that position to have to fire upon them. Excuse me.
That's right.
It's the language, the joking around and, you know, the laughing and everything. It's a coping mechanism. It's to push down everything else that you're feeling. I did it myself in Iraq. You tend to joke about everything just to push those other emotions down.
That's an important piece to talk about. I mean, I think that if you're, you know, whether you're a soldier, whether you're a police officer, whether you're a nurse in an emergency room, what you call gallows humor and banter is what people do to get through things.
Exactly.
You were telling me on the phone earlier, Ethan, and Josh, let me turn to you here. So let's get your comments on this first and then let Ethan tell us his own personal tale of this. I mean, this is, we have done a lot of shows here about soldiers who have been diagnosed and discharged with what's called a personality disorder. And there right now maybe well over 6,000 soldiers, maybe more, who have been diagnosed this way, which means you don't get your benefits, which means over the next the lifetime of a medical care for a soldier, the government might save they actually charge 22,500 soldiers because of personality disorder, saves the government $4.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And Ethan, you're one of those soldiers.
I am one of those soldiers, yes.
After you served, I have to talk about how you feel about the situation you're in. Starting with Ethan, then finishing with Josh Steiber. I mean, what that says to you, I mean, you served in combat. You put your life on the line and rescued these children and went through all this, did your service, and now you're being told you don't qualify for veterans benefits.
Well, I do qualify for veterans benefits from the VA.
From the VA, yes.
But, yeah. Now, as far as the Army, I have metal in my back now from the Army. I have wounds from actually being stabbed by someone else in the Army. I was diagnosed while in the Army with severe chronic PTSD and traumatic brain injury. And the Army, wanting to get rid of me quickly, decided that they were going to kick me out on what's called a Chapter 517, which is other mental disorders. But the question that I have is, I served 8 years in the military. How did I just all of a sudden have a other mental disorder? And it just all of a sudden happened after I came back from Iraq. But that's what they chose to release me on, and that's what I got released.
And Josh Steiber, I mean, you have been through a lot in the service as well, a combat veteran, and you've gone through your own story. When you hear what happens to comrades or in your unit like Ethan and what's happened to you, talk about your analysis of this, your perspective on this.
I mean, obviously it's very troubling, and I think points to where the military's priorities are. Another thing that seriously affected me was another friend of mine, when we came back, had a lot of trouble too. And initially after we got back, we had 3 weeks at the military base we were at in Kansas to supposedly decompress. And they said if anybody needs psychological help, then that's the opportunity for you to get the help. So we had 3 weeks for that. And then after that, we were able to go home and spend a month with our families. So my best friend, said he was having some psychological issues, and he went in and tried to get help, and they told him that they were too busy and to come back after the break. So he'd been told, and we'd been told all along throughout military training and throughout combat that, you know, this stuff really isn't supposed to affect you, but if for some reason it does, then we'll help you out. And here I have my best friend going in and saying that he actually does need help, and they tell him they can't help him until later on down the road. So he tries to take things into his own hands and solve things through alcohol, and he ends up getting drunk and making a really stupid decision and getting in trouble and not being able to go home and spend a month with his family when he's been away in war for over a year. And, yeah, just things like that, that the military talks a good game, whether it's during the military or whether it's how they choose to go about recruiting young, impressionable people. But when it comes to actually delivering, there's a lot that doesn't get talked about.
Before we end up having to go to break here, I just want you both to kind of think for a moment, just leave with the thoughts about when people who do oppose this war and people who are concerned about veterans see the video, like as was released by WikiLeaks, in trying to kind of expose the horrors of war, which it did, but instead we ended up blaming you and the men who were with you rather than the horrors of war. Let your message be left behind here for our listeners. Josh Stiber, we'll start with you, and I'd like to close out with Ethan McCord.
The message, or several messages, I guess, that I would have from this is that, again, this is what war looks like, and this video has been given the stamp of approval from the Secretary of Defense. That's about as high as you can get. So they've claimed this as being standard, and we've seen what war looks like, and now everyone, I think, who has seen this video has several responsibilities. We have a responsibility as American citizens to look at this video and ask if this reflects our values that we're in other countries claiming to be spreading freedom and democracy, and here we see what that looks like. And I don't think it takes a whole lot of imagination to put myself in a different country's shoes and understand why I wouldn't interpret things like that, even if they are militarily justifiable, as the spreading of freedom and democracy, or as somebody trying to help out my own country. And then also on a moral and religious level, as far back as my upbringing and education, and I went to a Christian school, never heard anything like this get talked about as morally wrong, and was taught that, you know, in war people get hurt. And I even tried writing to leaders of the church I grew up going to when I was troubled by different things in basic training, and they said, you know, that's just how things work. You need to have faith and have patience. So if our institutions that are claiming to stand for conscience and stand or claim to stand for some morals are excusing this behavior, then I think we're in a pretty dark place as a nation, and as people trying to hopefully do the right thing.
Ethan McCord?
Yes, as far as the video is concerned, with I've gone and I've checked out the video online on other sites and whatnot, and I've read a lot of the comments that people leave, and the comments that are being made is that us as soldiers are heathens, and trigger happy rednecks, and we're callous and we have no emotions for anybody. Now, you know, when people picture the Army, they picture that everybody's pretty much the same in the Army. When in all actuality, there's so many different people that make up an Army. Yeah, they may have said Army of One or Army Strong, but there's so many people who make up. There's Josh, for example. There's me. There's people who love the life that they're living in there. And then there's other people like ourselves who went thinking that we were doing something for a greater cause, and were wrong. And it seems to me that the only thing that we're doing is creating more terrorism, when our jobs over there were to out-terrorize the terrorists. it seems that's all we did over there was just try to out-terrorize the terrorists. And, you know, to the people at home, we need to not blame the soldiers. We need to take a look at the bigger picture of who's behind the soldiers and who's telling these soldiers what to do, or how is this started when you get into basic training. And one of your chances, I went to the park where all the children play, took out my gun, and I began to spray. You see, that's it starts to get embedded into these impressionable minds, and it turns into a lifestyle that you're living. And for some of the people who can't get out, and they begin to live that life, and that life is in turn going to turn over to the civilian life when they get out. We need to worry more about the veterans when they're coming home and making sure that these people are getting help, are getting their dues, because we're not all trigger-happy rednecks.
Ethan McCord and Josh Strauber, I really do appreciate you taking the time with us today. I mean, our listeners, and I thank you both for your service, and thank you both for your very honest and forthright conversation with us all. And good luck to both of you. We hope we talk again in the future. And thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's been an honor to have you both on. Folks, we want to encourage you to go to www.civsol.org. You can go to our website and find out more about these organizations and these men. And also the link to the WikiLeaks video is there as well. But think about this conversation as you watch it. We're going to take a short break and come right back to talk about refugees in Baltimore. So stay with us for that. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back.